This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome to Red Ice Radio. This is Henrik. Thank you for tuning in today. The website is RedIceCreations.com, where we highlight different areas of research that we find interesting and important. Joseph P. Farrell has a doctorate in patristics from the University of Oxford and pursues research in physics, alternative history, and science, including strange stuff. He's the author of 17 books in the field of alternative research. We have three topics that we're going to address in this first hour, beginning with the mysterious Baltic Sea find. After that, the Russian announcement of a new human haplogroup, which questions the out-of-Africa theory. And then after this, we're going to talk about Joseph's new book, Yahweh, the Two-Faced God, Theology, Terrorism, and Topology, that is co-authored with Scott D. DeHart. Right, welcome back to the program, Joseph. Good to talk to you again. Very interesting times. How does the world look to you from your perspective currently, Joseph?
Well, thanks for having me back on, Henrik. It's not looking too good, you know. It's, you know, the year of the apocalypse, and it looks like they're hard at work on it, you know.
Sure does.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to obviously talk about this a little bit later, the apocalypse culture, if you will, with focus on Yahweh, the Two-Faced God, the book that you and your co-author, Dr. Scott DeHart, put out here. It's probably over a year ago now, I think.
I think, yeah, it's probably more like eight or nine months, somewhere in that time frame. We did that last summer, and it was kind of a really nothing more than a memorialization of about 20 years worth of conversation.
Oh boy, yeah, yeah. Well, that's very interesting. We're going to get into it, but there are a couple of things here first. I'd like to ask you about things I know you've commented on your website, Giza Death Star. I always mispronounced that for some reason. GizaDeathStar.com. And the first thing is the Baltic object. We got to talk a little bit about that.
Right.
And then later we talk about the out of Africa theory that's kind of been challenged by some of the Russian scientists. But the Baltic thing first here, though. Speculated to be a lot of different things, of course, a UFO, a Stonehenge thing, it's a old submarine, and now more recently the Nazi connection, if you will, has come into this as well, that it's some kind of submarine that they built or some kind of anti-submarine device. What's your personal view on this, Joseph?
Well, I've been kind of watching that, Henrik, and as you know, I commented on this newly emerging Nazi hypothesis with respect to it. And I have to be very honest, I have a lot of problems with that hypothesis. It's being argued, the Russians kind of were among the first to put that idea out there. And the problem I have with it is that the people that are putting it out there are arguing that this was placed in the Gulf of Finland as a kind of submarine trap against Russian submarines operating against German shipping. Well, I'm a bit of an amateur military historian, and I don't honestly recall, Henrik, that there was a lot of German shipping flowing through the Gulf of Finland. Most, if I recall correctly, most of the German shipping was going down to southern Finland, you know, ports of, like Pori and so on. There may have been a bit of shipping up to the port of Vaasa on the western coast of Finland, but again, I just don't recall German naval operations were that extensive in the Gulf of Finland to warrant them putting, you know, a super secret submarine trap on the bottom of the ocean floor.
Right, right.
The only other major Nazi shipping that occurred in the Baltic during the war was in 1944, during the Soviet offensive that was called Operation Bagration. During that offensive, the Russians managed to cut off a significant segment of German troops in Courland, but the Germans mounted an operation to evacuate some of those troops. But, you know, other than that, there were not significant naval or shipping operations in the Gulf of Finland, which, you know, is way away from any of the major theaters that the Germans were directly involved with. So I have difficulty on that score alone. It just seems to be, to boil it down, it seems to be in the wrong place. All right, that's the bottom line. The other problem I have with it, Henrik, is to my knowledge, this thing does not, number one, resemble anything that I'm aware of or know about within Nazi weapons, secret weapons research. And for another thing, it's just far too large, as far as I'm concerned, for, yep, for anything that the Germans came up with. So I have a lot of problems, but the Nazi angle just doesn't make much sense to me.
Yeah, well, I would agree with that. I think one of the ideas, as you said, about this kind of anti-submarine thing is that it's a big mesh and then this kind of concrete, right, structure that the divers in the Ocean X team has described as being would be the basically the weight then that holds this down. And right, this would be one of the potential explanations why we see these kind of drag marks here as well, that something might have been actually been cut in the, or stuck into this and then right, trapped in that, or it upsets radar as well. There's a number of different functions. But yeah, I mean, again, it's about 260 feet down. I mean, do you, right, can you carry a 200 feet in diameter wide concrete object on a boat and it's dumped that into the ocean? Seems pretty,
well,
unlikely.
Yeah, this is the other thing. You know, if they're going to carry that or tow it, you know, it's going to require a major commitment of shipping. And, you know, again, for the Germans to do that, they probably could have done it, but the problem is it would have taxed their much, much needed naval resources elsewhere. And most of the, at that point in the war, most of their surface naval commitment was, you know, in Norway, trying to interdict the Allied convoys flowing to Murmansk. So to do something like that, it doesn't make much operational sense to me, and like I say, it's just in the wrong area altogether to be any sort of interdiction against Russian naval activity. It just doesn't make much sense to me at all.
Right, anyway. Right. I mean, the most, if you go into the Gulf of the Baltic there, I mean, the most, I think, northern harbor site that would have would probably be Lübeck or something like that. But I mean,
yes,
as far as I know, the major where they had their navy was obviously in Hamburg in the canal going out into the North Sea, basically.
Right.
You know, so I guess.
And at that point, like I say, at that point in the war, most of the German remaining surface units, heavy surface units, are stationed in Norway, which is, you right, know, far away from any field of operation there. So
yeah,
I just have a lot of difficulty with the whole Nazi explanation. It, yeah, just doesn't make much sense.
I think you're right. I think so as well. Well, and that now, if that's true, that excludes that portion, at least that theory of the, I mean, again, it could, of course, it could be anything. It could be something we haven't even thought about yet. But again, it's since it, right, seems to be stone or concrete that it's been described as, what the heck could it be?
Well, that I don't know. It's anybody's guess at this stage. I don't necessarily preclude that it's something human. It may have been a secret project of your country. It may have been something the Russians were involved with. But then again, you know, why are they going to be putting it there in the Gulf of Finland? I mean, if it was something that the Swedish military was doing, it would make more sense to me that it would be down towards Karlskrona and some of the big naval bases there. And if it were Russian, then again, I would think it would be much further south to, you know, aid their operations, particularly at that point, or aid their operations going on the Eastern Front. So the human explanation here of why that thing is there, there's nothing that really is making much sense to me at,
yeah,
this stage.
Yeah.
So, you know, that leaves where the ufology crowd is going with this, but I'm a little skeptical of leaping on that bandwagon at this juncture too. Until we really know more about what it is and, you know, what it's made of, what it's attached to, the drag marks and so on, I think we have to be a little bit skeptical of explanations, but I'm pretty certain the Nazis aren't involved with this one.
Now, there was another theory. Some people might recall the MS Estonia went down in the Baltic Sea back in 1993.
Right.
And there was actually pretty interesting research there. by Henning Witte. We had this lawyer with us on the program who'd done some investigation that there was actually a transportation of some potential exotic weaponry, potentially, or even nuclear in nature. I'm not sure, but that's there, you know, a potential theory. And that in some way then... Now, I think that this person is way too much up north into the Baltic Ocean where, well, let me be clear about this. The OceanX team hasn't actually really given out the location yet because they're afraid that people will, you know, go there. But right. The fact is that for some reason, none of the governments who were behind the salvage mission and everything has wanted to take up Estonia. It's actually been argued that it's going to be covered up, obviously. I don't even know if that happened yet, but it was going to be covered up with a sarcophagus, a concrete sarcophagus for some reason. And so some people argued, is that what this is? You know, but I'm not sure. I have to look into that further. Strange.
It may be. You know, we could be looking at anything. We could be looking at some sort of naval accident, as you say, that either the Russians may have covered over or Swedish naval forces may have covered over. We really don't know at this point. You know, that's a possibility. But you know, again, going back to the Nazi angle, it just doesn't make much sense to me, Henrik.
Yeah.
And until we know more, there's really nothing we can do but speculate. It may have something, like you say, to do with an accident that occurred Something had to be covered over. We simply don't know at this juncture.
That's right. We'll have to see. We're going to have Peter Lindberg from the OceanX team with us here in a couple of weeks. And they're out, or have just been out, I think, on their third expedition. And hopefully they'll have some more data at that point, and we'll see see what and if this could be, you know. All right. Well, let's shift over a little bit then. The one more thing I want to ask you a little bit about, and that was basically the... the Russian scientists released a journal basically just speaking out against the theory that everybody comes out of Africa, setting the scientific field in some opposition here. What's your take on this, Joseph?
Well, that was a blog that I actually put up on my website. The blog is titled "Russians Make Some New Human Haplogroup Announcements Questioning the Out of Africa Hypothesis," and it's kind of technical. But the bottom line here is that some Russian geneticists have discovered that there is a branch. Kind of, if you look at their chart of haplogroup groupings, there's kind of two clusters. And one cluster branches off quite early, and they've based this on tracking Y chromosomal data. And this suggests, the way it's clustered, suggests that there is a serious flaw with the out of Africa hypothesis. And let me read exactly what they stated in the article, and I'm quoting from my blog here. And this is from the first page of the Russian article, and this is what they say. Quote, "The concept was based primarily on the premise that Africa possesses the highest variability or variance of the human DNA and its segments set apart. It is not a strong argument because a mix of different DNA lineages also results in high variability." Pardon me. "And as we show below, it is largely what occurs in Africa. Moreover, a genomic gap exists between some Africans and non-Africans, which has also been interpreted as an argument that the latter descended from Africans. A more plausible interpretation might have been that both current Africans and non-Africans descended separately from a more ancient common ancestor, thus forming a proverbial fork." And that, of course, is referring to the fork in their diagram of these haplogroups. "A region where this downstream common ancestor arose would not necessarily be in Africa. In fact, it was never proven that he lived in Africa," close quote. Now, what they're referring to there is this diagram that shows these two rather major branches or clusterings of Y-chromosomal haplogroups. And what they're getting at, of course, is obviously the variability within the African line has led some geneticists to posit this out of Africa hypothesis that humanity basically genetically is related, comes out of Africa circa 150,000 years ago, and then migrates into Asia and then up through the Arabian Peninsula on into Europe.
Right.
And it's an interesting hypothesis what they're advancing here. From my standpoint, which is, of course, to view all of this in connection with ancient texts and particularly Mesopotamian texts that seem to strongly suggest that there has been some genetic tinkering that was done to humanity a long time ago. Now, what I find extraordinarily interesting about this article is that these Russian scientists have come to this conclusion by studying Y chromosomal groupings, in other words, males. All right. Now, that's interesting to me because if you go back and read those ancient Mesopotamian texts, I'm thinking in particular of the Karsag tablets. If you read those, what you discover is that the Anunnaki, who are supposedly doing all of this tinkering with man, it's precisely the male that contributes the Anunnaki genetic material into the creation of their chimerical species, mm-hmm. whatever they are.
Yeah.
And then it would be the hominid or proto-human females, if we can use that expression, that contributed the quote-unquote human element, all right? So I find that very interesting because it's another little indicator that modern genetics and these very, very ancient texts are squaring. And
yes.
What it's suggesting to me is that we have the possibility of a subsequent tinkering that may have been done in ancient times. And here's why I'm suggesting that. If you go back and read some of the texts that I refer to in Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, or for that matter in Grit of the Gods, a more recent book, one of the things that is very interesting, particularly in the Mayan Popol Vuh of all things, is that you have the so-called gods complaining that, okay, we've made this creature and it's far too smart for our own good. So we better go down there and interfere with it some more
and dumb it down. Yeah.
So, you know, there are these little strange indicators within some of these ancient texts and legends that, you know, not only were we tinkered with at one point, we were tinkered with at subsequent
several times,
to get us to the requisite degree of unintelligence, you know. this is kind of why I posted this whole article, because it seems to be yet another strange little corroboration. Of course, I'm not basing everything on it. I just found it rather interesting that these Russian geneticists would have come to these types of conclusions based on their study, because it's very clear when you read what they're saying that this second major branch that's clustered around one of these Y chromosomal haplogroups occurs so early that it makes the out of Africa hypothesis very, very difficult to swallow. So,
do they put a year on this?
I'm looking at the article right now, and as far as I can tell, it seems to be that they're situating it around 132,000 years ago.
That's right. That's the number I pulled out from there as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that does kind of knock the whole out of Africa hypothesis into a cocked hat. So it's going to be interesting to see if the world of genetics even responds to this.
Well, it would be a big exclusion, omission if they didn't, right? So.
Well, yeah, it's going to be a big exclusion and omission if they didn't. But on the other hand, it's going to require a lot of major rethinking.
Something they're not prone to do easily.
Something they're not prone to do easily, that's right.
Yeah.
You know, it remains to be seen how this is going to float, but it's a very, very interesting article.
It is. So what could this have this, if this is a different group, is that pretty much in spread around globally right now? Or is there any indication of this, or has this been kind of diluted further and there's no further evidence of them, if you will, if they're different?
I honestly don't recall what the geographic spread is from that article.
Yeah.
I'd have to go look at the original article and reread the whole thing. And to be honest with you, Henrik, I just don't recall.
Yeah.
My impression, and it's nothing more of an impression of a very faint memory from the time I wrote the little blog, my impression is that they were concentrating primarily in this particular branched off haplogroup on European males, which is another interesting problem if you get into the whole history of Y chromosomal Adam, as geneticists call it, and then mitochondrial Eve. Yeah. Because for some reason, the whole European stock seems to have a lot of problems with it. So, you know, it remains to be seen. And the other reason, you know, that brings me to the other reason I posted this article is because you have a group of people out there, for want of a better expression, that are nothing but white racist bigots, you know, supremacists, neo-Aryans, whatever you want to call them, mm-hmm. that try and leap on all of this stuff as yet more proof of you know, that the white race is somehow fundamentally different than the rest of humanity. And my point in posting this article and citing the passages in it that I cite is that the Russians are not saying this at all. What they're really doing is they're pushing this common male ancestor that geneticists are fairly certain now existed. They're pushing him further back into history. In other words, they're pushing it beyond the dates that are normally ascribed to the out of Africa hypothesis. That's the real point that's going on here.
Yeah.
So not only are geneticists possibly going to have to rethink the out of Africa hypothesis and who goes where and when they go, but they're also going to have to possibly rethink the whole chronology.
So, yeah, know, that's right. Yeah.
The whole thing now with this little article may be up for grabs.
Yeah, we'll see. And I agree with it. The interesting thing here is about the potential proof that this might add on to the pile of potential genetic engineering, as you said, that so many people have been interested
yes.
in. And one of the passages as well in your blog article is the following. It is additionally interesting that so many ancient myths, as you mentioned, Joseph, from the Norse to the Japanese, seems to indicate that some group of very European-described humanoids interacted with their local cultures and populations. So again, we're back to that idea that these are, I don't know, potentially they were involved in building a high culture, if you will, potentially, I don't know, that later fell or something happened. What's your take on that?
This is the other strange thing. You do have something going on in ancient times with respect to Caucasian or white peoples. You have, you know, the myth of the Yamato in Japan, where the Japanese legends say, just like many other legends far halfway around the world in Latin America and North America, of this group of red-headed, blue-eyed, you know,
yep.
bearded white people that come and teach civilization. Well, this may be kind of a little genetic confirmation with the existence of a sort of subdivision, a large subdivision of haplogroups around the Y chromosome.
Mm.
It may be an indicator that there's some truth to these legends. Who knows? I tend to think that as we get further into genetics, more and more of these ancient legends are going to come up for review. I just think it's an unavoidable thing that's going to happen now. It's looking too convenient. You know, I mean, my word, Henrik, I spent a great deal of time in Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men talking about how the ancient Mesopotamian texts seem to indicate that there were, I think, 13 or 14 human donor mothers in this genetic experiment, and one so-called Anunnaki male donor, all right? And if you look at the haplogroups that some of the geneticists are talking about, particularly Brian Sykes in Oxford, if you look at some of those, they're talking in terms of 13 major clan mothers. Well, you know, that's one off from what the ancient texts are saying. So the more they dig, the more it looks to me like they're uncovering little strange things that seem somehow to dovetail with a lot of these ancient myths. So I think it's kind of an exciting time. I suspect that it's going to send all of us back to the drawing board, you know, geneticists and people like myself working in the alternative research community. I think it's going to send all of us back to the drawing boards eventually.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's very unfortunate, as you said, that this is being turned into some kind of, you know, racist issue.
Well, oh, yeah.
I mean, whatever. It is what it is, and we just want to find out what really happened. Now, I'm also intrigued by, I remember a while back, the Chachapoya, the people, the Cloud Warriors, I think they were called. And this could be one of the same here, actually.
Yes.
Because they were described as being, you know, fair-skinned,
right.
Very, very white, and ideas that they went up to hide up in the mountains, and some people connected that with the potential catastrophe that was looming at the time. That was the reason why they stayed up in the mountains, and then later the Incans, I think, got in contact with them in some way, basically. But they were basically
right.
European-looking, I guess. So,
interesting. You have those stories from the Incas. You have very similar stories from the Maya, the Aztecs. I think there are some North American Native Indian traditions of similar effect. I mean, you find these things all over the world, this at the minimum, if these legends, if there's any basis of historical reality to them, then it means that this group of people, whoever they were, dispersed themselves around the world somehow. And of course, that's going to raise other questions for standard academic history as well. So it's going to be an exciting time if the Russians pursue this line of research.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like I say, it's going to send everybody back to the drawing board.
It's interesting also how many of these, we can consider them alternative theories at this point, or seem to be coming out from Russia, but they're not at all picked up by the rest of the Americans and Europeans and other around the world either.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, Henrik, because, this is something you notice not only in terms of Russian scientific thinking and genetics. It's particularly true of Russian thinking in physics.
Physics, exactly. Yes.
Yeah, my word. You know, you go back to some of the papers that were publicly published in the Soviet Union, and occasionally Russian scientists would submit the papers to Western journals, you know, and I think what they were doing is kind of sending up little trial balloons to see if anyone in the West was noticing what they were up to.
Right.
And, you know, they either were met with a big yawn or were simply ignored, not commented on at all. And the Russians are, you know, the Russians don't think in the same box as the rest of the world. And I think, you know, if the West continues to defend these scientific dogmas like they do, I think pretty soon you're going to see Western science eclipsed.
You go. Exactly. Yeah, and that's why it's so important to keep up with it, and also just the evidence leads where it leads. What's so dangerous about it? But we understand, of course,
exactly,
that there is an agenda behind it, and it is controlled.
Exactly.
Now, unless there's anything else, Joseph, you want to comment on that, I think we should shift over to the book here.
All
right. It's going really quick, as it always does with you, Joseph. So let's kind of dive into it. I mean, the title, Yahweh, the Two-Faced God, with a subtitle of Theology, Terrorism, and Topology. Give us a preface, if you will, of the book, Joseph.
Well, this little book is kind of a memorialization of conversations that my co-author and I, his name is Dr. Scott DeHart. He's been a friend of mine for almost 20 years, and like me, his background is in academic theology. So we approach things from kind of a textual point of view, and it grew out of conversations, really, Henrik, that we'd had for 20 years discussing some rather disturbing things, and not the least of which is the character of Yahweh in the Old Testament, primarily in the books of Moses, but, you know, certainly not limited to those books. And the bottom line is this. You have in the character of Yahweh, by any objective moral evaluation, you have a psychopathic, genocidal, murderous, manipulative, emotionally abusive character, claiming, according to theological tradition, to be God. And this is the problem. And, you know, being academic theologians, you know, we were trained in all the tricks of the trade, so to speak, you know, to how to deal with this. But the bottom line is, if you look at church history, the early church fathers, they themselves, you can kind of sense are grappling with this whole problem. And the bottom line that we came to in this book, that we were trying to get people to realize, is no amount of theological jugglery will change the fact that you're dealing with a real moral ambiguity with this particular character. Mm-hmm. If we were to take the same actions and ascribe them to a human being, then what we're dealing with is a character on the order of a Stalin or a Hitler or a Chairman Mao. We're dealing with a real murderous character. And there's no really good moral explanation for why all of these murders are even being ordered. So that was our first point in the book.
Yeah.
And the second point we try to make in the book is that, all right, if once you accept this moral schizophrenia, then let's look at the cultural effect of subscribing to one of the three Yahwist traditions. And of course, by that we mean Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The cultural effect of the introduction of this religion in ancient times was that it introduced a schism in the social space, because it's defining itself constantly in the books of Moses as being in opposition to something that preexisted it, and whether it be Egypt, whether it be paganism, whether it be idolatry, it's always got to have something in which to be in opposition. And when you start looking at what it's in opposition to, in the case of Egypt, what you're dealing with is an opposition to the so-called nature religions, or if you prefer to call it the perennial philosophy. In other words, that great metaphorical religion of a primary undifferentiation that differentiates itself, that great philosophical tradition that you find running all the way from China through India, on into Mesopotamia, into Egypt, you know, through the Greeks and the Platonic and the Neoplatonic tradition, the Hermeticists. You know, this is a huge tradition that Yahwism is defining itself in opposition to. And once you've seen that, then there's a third consequence that we talk about in the book, and that is that you enshrine a book, you enshrine a text as the basis of knowing God. And this is in complete opposition. It's completely different than the types of religio-philosophical systems that preceded it, where it's not a text so much as it is an understanding of nature itself that you're dealing with. So, you know, this is the basis for the biblical prescriptions against not worshiping things that are creatures and so on and so forth, mm-hmm. because that's all part of this nature religion that is defining itself in opposition to. And the final point that we have to look at, and we talk a bit about this in the book, is that Yahwism is a revolution, therefore. It's a conceptual revolution. And it's a moral, or as we would see it, an immoral revolution. And like all revolutions, it has a founding moment in violence. And the founding moment in violence is, of course, the Exodus, all right?
Yeah.
And in this respect, it's very interesting that, you know, you have so many times in history since then, you have this pattern repeated. The Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. To a certain extent, you have the French Revolution, you've got the Nazi putsch. All of these things follow some founding act of violence. And in this respect, Yahwism is no different. So, you know, it fills all the bills of revolutionary, violent movements if you strip off all of the religious connotations of it. So in other words, it's the bottom line is for us is it's a grab for power.
Yeah.
Nothing more.
Yeah.
It's nothing more than that. And from that point, you know, we go into explorations of American civil religion. I don't even want to call it Christianity because it has so little to do with anything that's historically connected to Christianity. But we go into explorations of the relationship between this absurd doctrine that you see with evangelicals, you know, the rapture and everything, and the tie to the modern nation state of Israel and why that's there. So it, you know, we cover a lot of ground in that little book.
Yeah, for sure. It's very interesting, and there's many aspects of this I want to ask you about. It's almost like I don't know where to begin, but obviously we described first there is a religion, if we even can call it that existed before Yahwehism, which more prone to, you know, it's been called paganism, of course, but it's, I mean, that's not really the correct word, I think, for it. But maybe shamanism, it's a religion based on the natural order of how the world works and the forces in nature, basically.
Right.
And so what do you think, what kind of fruit comes out of a religion that, again, creates this disconnection to nature that like separates itself from that and calls it evil? What happens in that
moment?
Oh
boy, that's a great question. In a nutshell, what happens is several things. First of all, you enshrine a text. The text literally becomes your god. All right, you enshrine, in other words, a system and a system of interpretation, and therefore you elevate to positions of authority a clerical elite that does the interpreting. All right, that's the first thing it does. The second thing it does is that it introduces into the psychology of anybody following the religion and doing so with, you know, good consciousness, doing so with the real intention to at least at some point live out the tenets of the faith. All right, now what we mean by this is that within the psychology of the individual, within one of those three Yahwisms, it introduces the idea that any other human being, therefore, is looked at in purely mechanistic terms. And what we mean by that is that they're viewed either as a potential convert to the system or as a potential enemy.
Right.
So in other words, the net social effect, the net cultural effect of these types of revelation religions is that it introduces a schism, a split in the social space. It introduces division in the social space.
Well, what was the, what was the quote, Joseph? Either you're with us or you're with the terrorists, right?
Exactly, exactly. That is exactly the mentality that, and obviously by quoting it in that context, you're pointing out that this has huge political and therefore geopolitical implications. Now, the effect, in other words, is to keep humanity divided. And as a consequence of this idea of a revelation, and we'll get back to that in a moment here because that's another important point. But as a consequence of this, it also means that the truth claim of the system with each of these three systems, you're dealing with universal truth claims. The problem is that not everybody is adhering to the universal truth, as you've just pointed out.
Mm-hmm.
So that means the final triumph of truth, according to these traditions, lies in the future. And that future, if you look at the future, is at some point a future that involves coercive violence. In all three versions of these traditions, you have the Imam Mahdi and the final triumph of Islam, where everybody submits to the will of Allah, which of course is interpreted by the Imams and Ayatollahs. You know, so in other words, the other effect of this is it enshrines an authoritative oligarchical elite
yep.
that does the interpreting of the text.
That's right.
In the American version of this, you have this, you know, hideous pre-tribulational rapture doctrine that for one thing, people have to understand this is not the doctrine of any sort of historically connected Christianity, be it Anglicanism or Roman Catholicism or Eastern Orthodoxy or Lutheranism, you know, any of those Christian traditions that have some sort of awareness of the unfolding of Christian doctrine in history. Because the bottom line in those traditions is, if you understand the doctrine of Christ, the incarnation, within standard Christian dogmatics, that is meant to be a once-for-all final sacrifice that abolishes for all time and in all places any return to Old Testament system of animal sacrifice and so on. So in other words, by teaching the rapture doctrine and the idea that the people left on earth that want to approach God, what they're really saying is that they have to do it through a reinstitution of Old Testament sacrifice. Now, the bottom line in historical Christian doctrine would be to say that that very teaching is a denial of Christ. That's the bottom line right there. Mm-hmm. So you have a major departure within American civil religion with this, the rapture doctrine. You have a major departure, and you have the creation of a doctrine that really serves no other purpose theologically than to enthrone the Jewish people once again as a specially selected chosen group of people that American foreign policy must support at all costs. Otherwise we incur the wrath of Yahweh, you know, and he's not a nice guy, you know. So the whole thing, just to boil it down, is just plain nutty, all right?
Amazing.
Now, I mentioned we have to look at the idea of revelation itself. Within the what I like to call the kind of perennial philosophy, religions, if you want to call them that, or systems of thought, you don't have the claim being made that all of these things come about by some sort of special revelation. You certainly have claims of enlightened teachers. You certainly have claims of faithful disciples, but there's not this idea that they're getting a direct communication from, you know, the Almighty himself. With the Yahwist traditions, on the other hand, you are dealing precisely with such a claim in each and every instance. The whole Moses on the mountain, you know, speaking alone with God and then coming back down and telling everybody, hey, I've got a message from God.
Right.
Well, you know, if you recontextualize it just a little bit, you've got the same claim being made by George Adamski, you know, and the early contactees, because what's he do? Well, he takes a bunch of friends of his out into a desert. Okay. He tells them, wait here while I go over the hill and talk to this higher being. And, of course, he goes over the hill, and then he comes back, and he claims to have had, an encounter with a higher being who's given him a message.
Isn't that interesting, huh? Echoes of
yes,
that.
Yes, very interesting. You know, the structure is the same. if you look at one of the founding conceptualists of Christianity, of course, that would be St. Paul. And what does he claim? Well, he claims to have had a special revelation alone, of course, on a road.
on the way to, was it Damascus? Or
Damascus, right. Yeah. And, you've got the same sort of thing. If you turn to Islam, what do you have? Well, Muhammad is on the mountain, and he's claiming to get all of this by dint of special revelation from the angel Gabriel, and again, you know, the idea is the same, let's go out and slaughter everybody that disagrees with this. So the structure here is what I find rather interesting, because you find this same structure of revelation being touted in so many contactee cases in the early 1950s. You've got a revelation, you've got it being more or less alone, and then you've got to persuade the masses that you've been given a special message from higher beings.
That's right. Didn't Crowley had a similar thing, by the way? Aleister
Crowley?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Into the pyramid, and I don't know if it was there he received a message or if it was somewhere else. But anyway, that story, the archetypal story is there. Now, one of the scary thing and troubling issue is that, what if that's true?
Well, it may be, you know, but the real bottom line that we're trying to get at in Yahweh, the two-faced God, is so what?
Well,
is what is being said a moral program?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the bottom line, at least for Dr. DeHart and I, was no, it's not. So, you know, it may be that George Adamski had this wonderful encounter with Venusians, you know, who gave him all these messages of love, light, and peace, you know, just knuckle under to us Venusians. It may be that Moses had an encounter. But is the message itself something that you want to adhere to? That's the real key.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether, you know, for us, we never even talk about, did this really happen or not? It's not that which concerns us. What concerns us is the message itself.
So again, it's an occupation with the messenger as opposed to the message here in this case.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is, you know, this is something that you touch on, Henrik, that is very, very important for people to understand. And we kind of imply this in the book, although we don't come right on and say it. Because one of the tactics that is constantly used in these institutions is the tactic of manipulation by guilt. Well, if you're saying you don't trust us, you're saying you don't trust me, the messenger, you put it in human terms in order to gain people's adherence to the message that you're delivering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, it's particularly pernicious when you stop and think about it. Because what it does is it switches off the critical and moral faculty.
Yeah.
And, you know, what we're trying to do is jar people enough, you know, to wake them up, to at least get them to consider that maybe there is something drastically wrong with the whole system.
Yeah.
And there is, you know, the bottom line for us, of course, is that there is something drastically wrong with the system.
Yeah.
It's produced nothing but division. It's produced nothing but bloodshed. There is no way, in spite of all the best efforts of all the best theologians in history, and we know quite a few of them, you know, that's what we studied, you simply cannot dispel this problem. That's the problem right there.
Yeah. Now, I know that this then might not be an issue that you deal with in the book, but it might be an interesting in other, you know, for other reasons. Could it be explained in some way why these people are having these experiences? As I said before, either it could actually really be true, which means that someone then is really trying to manipulate humanity, someone who probably is not humanity, most likely in a way. Mm-hmm. Or is it simply a psychosis or of some kind, and this is an illusion? And then, but the bottom line is, as you're alluding to, is that massive amounts of people are ready to lay down their own lives for this message that was received by something that they themselves might not even have seen or heard or gotten in contact with. You know.
Well, this is another excellent question, and you know, it brings up how different these experiences are from what you earlier referred to as shamanistic experiences, because to my knowledge, I'm not aware of anyone having shamanistic experiences that returns with a message that they've got to go out and convert everybody and slaughter those who don't convert. This is what sets it apart. Mm. This is the core defining message of the Yahwist traditions, is that they have to have something to be in opposition to.
Yeah.
In order, that's how they define themselves. You know, it's very clear in the first five books of the Old Testament that there is something that is out there that is the cause for the separation, and that something is Egypt. Egypt becomes the symbol of everything rejected, everything that's gone before. You know, all of that perennial philosophical tradition. And that's, you know, if these things really did happen, let's play this out a little bit. If there really was someone communicating with Moses, then it stands to reason that the agenda behind it would be to turn away or to reject those perennial philosophy religions, so to speak, because, number one, there has to be something tremendously empowering about those religions, and number two, there has to be something threatening about those religions to a narrow group of people that are pursuing their own power. Mm. That, I think, is part of what's at root here. Let's go back to something that I've pointed out, and maybe this will help illustrate this concept a little better. I've pointed it out several times in my books. Way back in the Giza Death Star Deployed, I talk about it again in Cosmic War, I talk about it again in Grid of the Gods. It's kind of a recurring theme. And that's what I call the Tower of Babel moment of history. And incidentally, that's not my expression. That was Leonard Bernstein's expression, mm-hmm. the conductor and composer. The Tower of Babel, if you look at the story, the way it's recounted in the book of Genesis, you have a very interesting thing. And that is that God, which in the Hebrew at this point is the word Elohim, coming down and scrambling the languages of man. And the reason that's given there is very peculiar. Nowhere in the text does it say that what humanity is up to is sinful. You can only get that by reading into the text similar such statements by God, mm-hmm. from the other parts of the Old Testament. But in that story itself, nowhere does God say, what they're doing is sinful, we got to go down and stop them. What is said is that if mankind completes this thing, whatever it is, then he will be able to do whatsoever he imagines to do. It's as if, in other words, it posed some sort of threat. So we got to go down there and scramble mankind's languages.
Yep.
Now, that's an interesting reading of the text. And again, I'm reading into it just as much as people reading into it the other way. But it's a reading that makes sense because in the other versions of that story, from Mesopotamia to the Mayans, you will find that the gods are complaining of mankind, and therefore we got to go down and split them up somehow, mm-hmm. because what mankind is up to is a threat to the power of the gods.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, I think we really have to start looking at, we have to start looking at the biblical text in a certain way. And part of that way would be to look at it just like the higher critics did in the 19th century as being the product of an agenda and of an elite that has an agenda.
Indeed.
And once we start looking at it that way, then we have to start making very careful thematic analyses and comparisons of these little pericopes and stories and vignettes with other traditions to see if maybe the explanation for these events in the biblical text is either obscured or amended or altered in some way. Once we start doing that, then very different things start popping out.
Now, I want to ask you one more thing here before we take a short break here between the segments. If you consider that to be any, basically, validity in the text, I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, the Bible is incredibly, it's a big book, right? There's a lot of stuff in there. There's contradictory stuff. There's things that are in opposition to itself if you read it, and you can cherry pick one version out of it, if you will, and then another on the other side. So it's very complex to understand that. But if we have people like, you know, for instance, Joseph Atfield that argues that this is the Flavians, basically. They have written up this whole story because it was beneficial to them. And then here is direct evidence that the elite in cahoots with the Josephus and the Alexandrians, you know, that they've come together in that in Rome at that time to create it. And in that sense, then we can understand maybe, as you said, what the purpose is behind it. But in your view, Joseph, is there any reality in the text? Is this real accounts of real things that really happened, or is it all bunk in your view?
no, I think there's reality to it, just as I think there's reality to the texts of the Maya or the texts of the Sumerians or the texts of the Hindus. I think there's reality to them. The problem is that we're dealing, I think, first of all, Henrik, with memes or stories that are very, very ancient. In other words, they're much older than the texts themselves. And, pardon me, and once you put things that way, then you have committed yourself to a program, really, of having very carefully to reconstruct what might be going on. And I emphasize the subjunctive mood here, because no one's reconstruction is going to be 100% accurate, and the more analysis and examination along those lines that one does or that other people do, the more things are going to be changed in terms of our looking at it. But I definitely think that there is some historical kernel that is true. The real question, and this is the question I hope eventually someday to address in a book, maybe in cahoots with Dr. DeHart, I don't know. But the real question is, once you've admitted a kernel of reality, then the question becomes, is there someone like a Yahweh character or an Archangel Gabriel or what have you behind these texts and events, or are they simply being created by a priestly elite or perhaps even stories handed down in those elites and then being modified and circulated publicly by those elites with an agenda? That's the real question, I think, that has to be asked. And the reason I put it in those terms is because, you know, I referenced earlier the 19th century higher critics. They were sort of saying the same thing. What they were doing is, if you read those people from Johann Michaelis all the way up to Julius Wellhausen, you know, that great arch of German biblical scholars that constructed over time what's known as the documentary hypothesis. Mm-hmm. If you look at the work that these people are doing, what they're really doing, Henrik, is in very academic terms and without using the words, what they're doing is that they're putting out a conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
That's what they're doing. So, you know, in reference to the Flavians and the thesis of Atwill and so on, you know, they're simply extending the implications of that sort of approach to the text. Now, with regard to Atwill, I would only say that I think he's onto something, but I don't think he's cast his net far enough back in history and far enough forward in history, nor do I think he's cast his net widely.
I know he's working on the forward part right now, but
yeah.
Back, what Egypt further beyond, what is that what you're talking about?
Well, yeah, there's been for a long time a body of work out there associated with esotericists. In some cases, it's associated more recently with the so-called new chronology people. But there's a body of work out there that has long recognized astrological themes, for example, in the Book of Revelation.
Right.
There's been a body of work out there with, if you know, certain works within the occult or esoteric field, there's been a body of work that has taken pretty much the whole Bible and deconstructed it along the lines of Egyptian religion. You know, you don't have to read very far. I mean, you can pick up any English translation of the Egyptian pyramid text, for example, and read the very first page, and you, all of a sudden you find yourself reading something that clearly has resonances with the opening of the Gospel of St. John.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And turn a couple pages later, and pretty soon you find yourself reading something that clearly is the basis of the Lord's Prayer, you know, the Pater Noster.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you don't have to read very far at all. So, you know, there's been a body of scholars for some time that have been pointing these things out. what like, is happening.
Gilgamesh and Genesis, you know, the
Gilgamesh and Genesis and, you know, the whole nine yards. You know, in Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, I mentioned one of the most famous ones, the German Assyriologist by the name of Friedrich Delitzsch. You know, his famous, or if depending on your life, infamous book called Babel und Bibel, you know, Babel and the Bible.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this is a guy that was literally summoned to present his findings in front of the Kaiser and his court.
Wow, very good.
and this behind closed doors, so to speak, and in executive session. And somehow... you know, somehow word of this presentation to the Kaiser and his court leaked out into the public press, and it caused a firestorm of controversy, not, you know, as you can imagine, in Imperial Germany, and then it spread very quickly to the rest of Europe.
Yeah.
And poor Kaiser Wilhelm, you know, had to step in and settle the whole thing in his capacity as the supreme bishop of the Lutheran Church. You know, let's just all table this and go back to being nice to each other.
Right,
you know?
But,
you know, you can kind of sympathize with him, because, you know, what Delitzsch did was he let out the fact that you can find the name Yahweh in cuneiform tablets that predate the books of Moses by some 1,000 years.
Oh boy.
So, you know, yeah, that was a king-size monkey wrench, you know, that because that name is supposed to be the name given in a special revelation. Well,
yeah.
You know, there's that little problem. And then, you know, in the Hebrew of that particular theophany in Exodus 3, it says, Ea Asher Ea, you know, and that's usually translated in the English as I am who I am. You know, the name I am being the name Yahweh, and that's supposed to be the special revelation of the supreme principle of being, and therefore this is a claim to being deity. Well, the problem here is that the name Ea in I think in Western Akkadian is the name for the Mesopotamian god Enki.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
So in other words, you could have, in typical Semitic fashion, you could have a very dense pun being made here. You know, I am Ea. So, you know, that throws yet another monkey wrench into the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, the possibilities, you know, these are little detailed nitpicky things, but I'm mentioning them to show just how really complex all of this is.
Yes.
Once you start entertaining these ideas of deconstructing the text.
That's right.
That's how complex.
And so these things given, and I know that there is more than this, of course, that you mentioned now, but that means then, okay, we have the Bible, and to me personally, obviously based on other previous traditions, if you will. So,
right.
Okay, we're going to take a break in a little bit here, but let's continue a little bit more on this. Is there a problem here in terms of, okay, so can we attribute even quote unquote blame the Bible for the fruits that what has come out of it, or do we again then, as you said, need to go back further and now look at those religions that have set this in motion?
That's a question you want me to take on the other side or answer now?
Let's dive into it right now, and then we'll take a break
all
after
right.
that. Yeah.
Well, basically, again, I think you have to go back to what we said at the very beginning of the discussion, that in these systems you're enthroning a text. All right. And by enthroning the text, then you're also enthroning the magisterium that interprets the text. And this is true, you know, within Judaism, with the rabbinate. It's true certainly within Christianity, with the whole idea of church fathers, apostolic succession, bishops. You know, the Roman Church has made a whole area of theology nothing but the study of the magisterium, the teaching authority.
Mm.
Within Islam, of course, you have the idea of tradition, of hadith, of consensus, of sharia, and of course that again comes out of the enthronement of a clerical elite that strains over the text and squeezes every last drop of meaning from it. So in a certain sense, yeah, I think you can blame the text. Now, when you put it in the context of having to look at it from the standpoint of looking at other traditions that have similar stories and pericopes and vignettes, then when you look at it that way, I think it becomes even clearer that within the biblical versions of some of these stories, you have either a heavily obfuscated story, or you have a story that has been told in a way to empower the elite in charge of the text. And again, I go back to the example of the Tower of Babel. In the biblical version, again, you've got kind of an ambiguous story that you can interpret God's intervention as being, you know, we're going to go down there and punish sin and prevent mankind from really screwing himself up and do so by confounding the languages. You can interpret it along those conventional theological lines. Or you can interpret it in the context of the other versions of the story in other non-Yahwist traditions where it's very clear that the reason for the intervention is not so much because what mankind is doing is sinful, but rather a threat. In other words, it's pure politics in these other texts.
Yeah.
And in the biblical version, it's kind of glossed over in such a way that you can interpret it in either way. It's not coming right out and deceiving you or lying to you, but it's constructed within a context that permits the conventional theological and spiritual explanation of it. That's the problem. So, yeah, I think you have the possibility that you can look at some of these stories and see the clear hand of an agenda and an elite at work behind the text.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that goes to the heart of what we mentioned before, having people waking up to this and realizing what's going on and start thinking for themselves instead of just mindlessly putting their own self in the hands of authority, elite, other people, what have you, you know. So definitely.
Well, this, you know, to kind of maybe close out this section, I always ask people, and if you get an honest response from people, this is a very arresting question. To people in those religions, I always ask them, would you kill your neighbor if God commanded you to? Because this question embodies or encapsulates the moral problem that exists within those Old Testament texts. That's it precisely. If you find hesitation, then psychologically what that indicates to me is that the person realizes, is confronted with, whether they would admit it publicly, they're confronted with the basic philosophical and moral problem. At that juncture, that's where, you know, the theological jugglery usually comes in. You find all sorts of explanations being offered. But the real bottom line for the honest people is the honest ones will say no. And at that point, when they say no, that's when the real questioning and the real honest evaluation begins to start.
Yeah, yeah. Now, we're going to carry on here. Obviously, this is very interesting. I can't wait to proceed in the next segment, hour two, there in our member section. But before we take a break, the website that you need to bookmark and follow is GizaDeathStar.com for fascinating and frequent updates on the topics that Joseph Farrell follows. And of course, if you scroll down right there on the front page, there's a link to the book, Yahweh, the Two-Faced God. Just click the cover right there. You'll get over to Lulu.com. If you want to read more about the thoughts and the work from Joseph Farrell and Dr. DeHart, pick up a copy of the book, of course. And it's also available, I think, Joseph, in Kindle version, right?
No, it is no longer available in Kindle. And the reason why, I got an email from Amazon saying that they had withdrawn it because their formatting will not handle the mathematical notation.
Oh, really?
So the only version now is the Lulu.
Have to turn it into an image, I guess, huh? Or something like that.
Yeah.
Strange.
Right.
Okay. Well, in any regard, a hard copy and is available at lulu.com. We're going to have links, obviously, up to the book as well. And check out Joseph's other work as well. You have, how many books do you have now? Is it 15 more?
I've got 16 out now. Dr. DeHart and I have one coming out this fall called Transhumanism. I just finished another one that's a sequel to Babylon's Banksters. I'm currently writing a sequel to Saucer, Swastikas, and Psyops. So I've got 16 out in English now. I think there's three or four in Russian. There's a couple in German, a couple in Polish, and one in Italian. So, and soon to be Chinese.
Oh, so. There you go. Interesting. How's the sales on those? Do you keep track on that in the other languages?
I don't know anything about the Russian sales because apparently Russian law is a bit different than the rest of Europe, so I don't actually get royalties or commissions on sales in Russia. In Germany, sales have been fairly good. I have no idea about Poland because I think the law there in Poland is different. I haven't heard anything about sales in Italy. I don't know. And the Chinese bought Babylon the Banksters, so it's going to be very, I don't know how that's going to work.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, that's good. Good stuff. All right, well, we'll take a little break here. GizaDeathStarAgain.com, that's the main website. Stay with us, Joseph. We'll be right back with more after this short break.
I take time thinking about the moves I'm gonna have to make. I take time thinking about the rules I'm gonna have to break. It's always push and shove in. Sometimes it comes to nothing. Sometimes it's more than a mere mortal man can take. I'm up for it. I'm up for it. I'm up for it. I'm up for it. Such a trip. The mediocre can make you lose your grip. It's all on you and what you've got. You can play it cool or make it hot. I pay the price and take my shot. Stay up for it. I'm up for it. I'm up for it. I'm up for it. Take time thinking about what I'm gonna have to do. What it takes, how it is, and when I'm gonna light the fuse. All this pushing, shoving, in the end all amounts to nothing. I'll never get a second chance looking me in the face. I'm up for it. I'm up for it. Stay up for it. Stay up for it. I've seen them come and go so many times.
In the second hour for our members, Joseph speaks about religious indoctrination and nightmare apocalyptic fantasies that are tailor-made to serve the elite's geopolitical agenda. We will discuss Putin's opposition to Western oligarchs and the threat of Russian power to the elite's game. Farrell also talks about the European Union and the Eastern factions, which are creating an obstacle for the elite game players. Later, Joseph talks about the substandard individuals who are next in line for power after the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds. We end the hour discussing the positive aspects of our current state of the world. He reminds us that the problems are cultural, not political, and ties it back to Yahweh. Go to redicecreations.com to log in or to subscribe. As a member, you can listen to all our previous programs going back to 2006 in their entirety. We have some important programs coming up with Lauren Coleman on the Aurora Massacre. We have Kevin Annette, Linda Moulton-Howe, and Peter Lindbergh from the Ocean X team, plus many more. Full list of upcoming guests is available in our radio archive. Keep listening to Red Ice Radio. We'll be right back with Hour 2 together with Joseph Farrell. Stay with us.